Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'll ask the marshal to call us in, please.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfeld, Judge Reyes, Judge Smith, the Honorable Diane B. Bratfeld presiding.
Right, and good morning again for the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I was just checking a couple of my settings are different than the norm. Maybe it's just been a while since I've been on a Zoom oral argument, so excuse me if I look a little distracted. So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have a total of five matters on our calendar today. Four of those will be heard by oral argument. We are proceeding via the Zoom video conference platform, as everyone is aware. And so that means that this hearing is recorded. I will make a few comments before we begin the argument for the first case, but first I'd like the marshal to call the first case.
Calling A230481, Sally Cooper Smith Appellant versus Stephen C. Pychowski individually and doing business as SP Trucking LLC, Respondent, North Star Materials Inc., doing business as Knife River Materials, Respondent.
All right, and before we start the first argument, I just want to remind counsel, first of all, welcome, and we look forward to hearing the discussion today. Because this hearing is recorded, and otherwise, apart from the Zoom platform, our procedures are the same, and I just expect you to say something if you have any questions. But we do record today's proceedings audio and make that available later. And so we ask you to please identify yourself and the client you represent before you start your remarks. And then it should be visible to you that the amount of time remaining on the oral argument should be visible on your screen. And so please keep an eye on that because it tends to go fairly quickly. And with that, we're ready to hear from counsel for appellant. So you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, Clay Robbins on behalf of appellant Sally Cooper Smith. The case before this court involves a claim that arose from a multi-vehicle crash that occurred the early morning hours of July the 2nd, 2021 in Grand Forks, North Dakota. A Minnesota truck driver and a Minnesota contracting company that hired him were responsible for causing the death and injuries that occurred on the highway of North Dakota that early morning. The truck driver had limited insurance coverage that was available to him, and that coverage was exhausted by both the magnitude and the number of the claims that arose out of this terrible tragedy that happened that morning. So in the course of the proceedings of the case below, appellant decided to enter into a settlement with the truck driver and then obtain a release of the claims that we were making solely against that truck driver so that she could proceed with her seeking of a recovery against the contractor that negligently hired that trucker. A Perringer release was drafted by counsel for the trucker so that the appellant's claims against Knife River could proceed. That was done because a Perringer settlement does not release direct and independent liability claims against a non-settling defendant. It was explicitly entered into for that purpose. And we know that from the case in Minnesota known as Kellen versus Mathias. It does, however, extinguish wholly vicarious liability claims against a non-settling defendant. But here we're dealing with claims in count two and three of the complaint. Count two of the complaint is a negligent hiring or selection cause of action. And that is incorporated in its totality within count three, which seeks recovery for negligent infliction of emotional distress. The liability theories of the count two, which is the primary claim being asserted here, is a claim premised wholly upon the respondent's direct, independent, and active negligence in hiring a dangerous trucker to haul 60,000 pounds of hot asphalt over the highways of North Dakota.
Well, counsel, if I may, just because our time together, it will go quickly, I'd like to just direct you to a question that I have.
Sure.
It seems to me that you're going directly to the argument about whether the district court erred in dismissing the claim, entering summary judgment on the claim that you have against Knife River based on the Perringer release. And of course that is, properly raised on appeal, but it sort of presumes As you said, negligent selection is your primary theory. I think that's what you're saying.
Correct.
It presumes that negligent selection of an independent contractor is a valid recognized claim in Minnesota. And I know that's how you briefed the issue. You assert that it is. And I know the district court assumed that it was. But I just need to tell you straight up, having looked at your authorities, I don't see that Minnesota has recognized negligent selection of an independent contractor as a theory on which to base relief. Now, it certainly, there are a couple of cases that allude to it and reference that section of the restatement second of torts.
Right.
But there is no Minnesota Supreme Court case that has recognized the cause of action in a way that actually applies the cause of action.
I understand that. I understand the court's question about that. However, I believe, and I think that our briefing shows, that the theory underlying negligent selection is essentially identical to a negligent hiring claim. And there, Minnesota most definitely has recognized at the highest level of the Supreme Court in the Ponticus case, the theory of recovery of negligent hiring.
And, you know, counsel, we could have a long discussion about that, how similar negligent selection and negligent hiring are. But
right.
Yeah, I just want to stay in my lane as a Court of Appeals judge and recognize that, and you're familiar because it's been briefed in this case, there is some pretty, a number of cases from our Supreme Court as well as this court that have discussed when it is appropriate for the Court of Appeals to decide a question of first impression as opposed to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And so how are you going to persuade this court to decide the issue of recognizing negligent selection, even assuming it is, you know, virtually the same as negligent hiring? I'm just going to let you assume that for a second. So assuming how does the Minnesota Court of Appeals make that decision?
Well, I think it does so by extrapolating from what the court just recognized, and that is there is essentially an identity of theoretical underpinnings between a negligent hiring case where you're dealing with an employer. And I would point out that Lakeview Terrace involved a contractor. That wasn't an employer there. That was the case then involving
But Lakeview Terrace did not actually apply negligent selection. In fact, it stated that specifically in the decision.
Well,
so.
And yet it goes on and it in essence does apply. What it says is it doesn't necessarily, in that case, the court didn't necessarily find the facts to support the finding of a negligent selection claim, but it all but recognized and based its opinion upon a recognition that the courts essentially had adopted what is a negligent selection claim, a negligent hiring claim, because insofar as the theoretical underpinnings, Your Honor, I believe it there's really would only be looked at as being a distinction without a difference. Whether you're hiring an employee or whether you're hiring a contractor, the courts come to the conclusion that there must be some vetting of the competency of that individual, particularly where the hirer is going to be placing that individual into contact with the public.
I'm sorry. If I could ask just one more question, then Judge Reyes, you go ahead. So here's my fundamental question to you. Your argument assumes there's no difference between an employee and an independent contractor. And I am unaware of any Minnesota law that's ever said that. I mean, go ahead and point it out to me if I'm wrong. There certainly are cases that have acknowledged that there are bases on which the principal is liable for the acts of an independent contractor. We have a lot of exceptions to the general rule that the principal is not liable. But we have not blurred the lines, I don't think, in Minnesota between an employee and an independent. And if I'm wrong about that, just tell me, and I'll let you go on with the rest of your argument.
Well, but here, and what we're really looking at, Your Honor, is that we're not so much looking at the relationship itself between the hirer and the independent contractor or the employer and the employee. We're looking at and we're focusing upon the duties and obligations of he or she whom retains that independent contractor employee, and what does that individual have to do to make sure he is not or she is not exposing the public to a danger? So I think that there really is no difference in that aspect of the theory, which is the underpinnings of the theory itself. And so when these cases are speaking of what is the obligation of one who is going to be putting someone in contact with the public to vet that individual to make sure that you're not presenting a danger to the public, the obligations are the same, and I don't believe that there would be a difference in the theoretical underpinnings of those obligations, whether you're dealing with an employer-employee relationship or a higher independent contractor relationship. And I would acknowledge that there has not necessarily been a quote-unquote negligent selection claim, but I believe that the theory, as I've argued before, that the theoretical underpinnings of hiring or selection or retention and selection, we're basically talking about differences in the points in time at which the hirer or employer knows or should know that the employee presents a potential danger to the public. And that's the only difference between a retention and a hiring claim, too. So I think when we're dealing with this question of what the obligation of he who or she who hires an individual to do work for that individual must do, I think the obligations are identical. And I don't think it's a far stretch for an appellate court to say that Minnesota has essentially adopted that theory of liability as it would apply to anyone who seeks to put the public in or expose the public to a potential danger of one that that individual hires. But I Judge Reyes, if you had a question, I didn't want to cut you off.
No, absolutely. I did have a question. Thank you very much. And I share the same concern, and I'm going to maybe try to frame it in a different way. Mm-hmm. But I share the same concern that Judge Bradbold expressed is you talk about it's essentially the Minnesota has essentially adopted that this is a natural extrapolation of existing law. But here's my question. Is there any controlling Minnesota Supreme Court case law on negligent selection?
Using that language, negligent selection? No, Your Honor, there has not. The closest would be Ponticus.
My next question is, if there isn't any controlling case law, how can this court create, we're just an error-correcting court. We cannot create a new cause of action for negligent selection. Doesn't that fall to the Supreme Court or the legislature to acknowledge and create?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I do not believe that there is really a new, separate, and independent tort when we're talking about the whole theory, as I suggested to Judge Bradfold, when we're talking about what are the obligations of an individual who retains someone and puts that individual into contact with the public. To argue otherwise would be to say that Minnesota at this point has no law that would govern individuals who are in a contractor or a contractor relationship to do anything to vet them, that there would be no remedy against a person who, as in this case, does essentially nothing and puts a dangerous truck driver on the road that causes the chaos that this individual caused. And I don't think that the case law in Minnesota would embrace that. I think that the case law that we have shown, both in the Ponticus case, which is a Supreme Court case, that yes, we're dealing with hiring there. But we're also talking about Lakeview, the discussion of the whole concept in Lakeview Terrace, M.L. Magnuson, and then the U.S. District Court cases of Soto and Russ, both of which happen to be trucking cases as well. And all of these cases recognize that there is an obligation to review the competency of someone that you hire to put in in the way of the public, so to speak. And so whether you call it negligent selection, negligent hiring, however you call it, it is the process by which one person ask another to do work for them that may present a risk to the public. And there are
and counsel, I understand and I think you're raising a colorable argument as to whether or not negligent selection is you know, the same or similar to or a natural extension of existing case law. My concern isn't on the merits of the argument. My concern is as to whether or not we have the authority, based on your acknowledgement that there is no binding case law by the Minnesota Supreme Court, whether or not we can opine as to whether negligent selection of an independent contractor should be recognized. That falls to the Supreme Court, and they've made very, very clear that we cannot create new case law. We cannot create a new cause of action. That falls to the Supreme Court or the legislature.
Well, but I do believe that the Supreme Court, even in Ponticus, takes a look at the restatement second and agency and evaluate.
But that's the Supreme Court, though. That's not this court.
Okay, but what I am saying is the Supreme Court could points this court in the direction of the authorities that this court could look at in saying, yes, the negligent retention or selection of an independent contractor is sufficiently similar to the hiring of an employee that we follow the cases that we've cited in all of our briefs that have recognized that, yes, the Minnesota has effectively adopted both the restatement second of agency and the restatement second of torts. So talking about the obligation to vet independent contractors located at section 411. So I think you have the authority both as recognized by the Supreme Court in Ponticus, and you have the ability then to utilize the case law and say that, yes, that this holding applies not only to an employer-employee situation, but it also applies to a higher independent contractor situation, because essentially...
Mr. Robbins, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're just running so low on time. I just want to ask a question. Assuming there is such a cause of action, I'm trying to understand. I want to theoretically or understand how the impact of Parenter here. If you had a claim that if it went to trial, a direct claim for negligent supervision, and then there's a claim,
it'd be negligent hiring,
sorry,
negligent
selection.
Yes.
Sorry, selection. Wrong S word. Negligent selection. Would there be a, and there was no release of claims here. Would there be a division that would the jury be asked to determine how much responsibility to allocate to then Knife River for negligent selection, and then also to the driver slash his employer for the negligence and causing the crash?
The Parenter release in and of itself does allocate the responsibilities and the damages that are recoverable. And there is some deference given. In fact, the Knife River would have a benefit for the release that was given to SP Trucking. So, but and at the time of the at trial and the jury's instructions that would go to trial, the jury would be instructed on the theory of concurrent causes, and the jury presumably would be able to allocate the percentages of fault as among the various individuals there. But
I know I'm taking you over, Judge Bradfield. May I ask one more
go
question?
Ahead. Yeah,
thank you. I guess that part of my question goes to, it seems like in the briefing, and I want to hear from respond on this, there seems to be a conflation at some level, and maybe, I'm not sure, between vicarious liability, which is a relationship thing, and then this idea of derivative liability, if there's an element of the claim somehow. And I'm thinking as if the negligent, I mean, the argument I think is negligent selection is sort of would be like vicarious liability, and I'm having trouble with that concept, and I just wanted your response to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. And no, it is not. It is recognized by the cases that we cited, albeit talking about negligent hiring most, but I am using those cases to show that it is a direct, active, and independent theory of liability. And you can look at the restatement second of torts, and at sections 411 and sections 411, and I believe section Oh, 419, make the difference between vicarious liability on the one hand and the liability of a hire of an independent contractor on another. And the Restatement Second Torts recognizes that that liability of one who hires a contractor is direct and is independent and is not vicarious. So there, you're right. In the trial court, there was some conflation as to what is vicarious liability and what is not. And this is most definitely and is recognized in the negligent hiring cases as being not a vicarious liability theory at all, but rather a direct and active liability theory. And that's why that's why the Perringer release was drafted, because the Perringer only releases vicarious liability claims. And the case law in Minnesota recognizes that the hiring / selection claim is in fact not, just as the restatement section recognizes.
Thanks, Judge Bradfield.
Right. No, thank you, Judge Smith. And thanks to you as well, counsel. And you should know that you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose, and if you'd like to continue the discussion at that time.
Your Honor, with the court's permission, and I thank you, I would like to use the remainder of my 5 minutes or whatever time I have remaining on the rebuttal.
Oh, you'll get that chance. In Minnesota, it's automatic. So what will happen?
I thought my reply time was draining off. That's happening.
No. We're very generous with the oral argument, and it's because we appreciate it so much. So what will happen at the close of counsel for respondents' remarks is the clock will reset at 5 minutes. And if you choose at that time, you can use all of that 5 minutes. It's totally up to you, Mr. Robbins.
I shall. There are a couple of other issues that I would like to address, but I
know. You'll get a chance. So
and I thank the court for addressing the questions that it had in my portion of the oral argument, so I can address them hopefully directly. And with that, I would submit until rebuttal.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Zucker, I think we're ready. Did I say your last name correctly? I hope so.
You got it. Thank you.
All right. Good. And we're ready for you. The clock is reset. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Peter Zucker, and I am the attorney for Knife River in this case. There's really two issues that are dispositive on this appeal. And the first is whether a negligent selection claim, if it does in fact exist, is a derivative claim. If a negligent selection claim is a derivative claim, then the Perringer release bars the plaintiff's claims against Knife River. If it's not, then the Perringer release does not, if a negligent selection claim is in fact a viable claim in Minnesota. And the second issue is whether there's a circuity of obligation under the indemnity agreements that exist in this case. I'd first like to talk about what derivative liability is. So,
counsel, before you go there, do you want to say anything about whether this court should proceed to recognize negligent selection as a cause of action? If we don't, right, it's arguably an easy affirmance for you. With the exception of the NIED claim, which is also being pursued on appeal, which we haven't talked about, but, you know, we can fully brief to us. So we're going to, you know, that issue is presented. So do you want to address that? Because I just suggest that you start there, given our earlier discussion, but it's up to you, of course.
Yes. Couple things. I think everybody recognizes negligent selection hasn't been actually recognized in Minnesota. The other issue and the bigger issue that I had, and I really didn't touch on it that much because I think my other issues dispose of this appeal without getting into it. Negligent selection doesn't actually appear in the complaint. It's a negligent hiring claim, which
the district court decided it. It was argued and submitted, I think, on summary judgment. I mean, you're right. We could be very technical about this, but I'm not sure it would be fair in this standpoint. And you certainly have fully rebutted it. So the issue is, I think, teed up for the court in the sense that it was litigated below and decided below.
So in answer to your question and the fairness thing, I agree, which is why I didn't focus on it that much. But regardless, no, a negligent selection claim has not been recognized in Minnesota. If it were, I think under any test, the court would have to look at what the elements are that other jurisdictions have imposed on a negligent selection claim, and probably would look to the restatement. I mean, that's the place that courts usually go to. And under any test of a negligent selection claim, the accident has to have been caused by the independent contractor doing something wrong. That's the test. Without an independent contractor doing something wrong, a negligent selection claim doesn't exist. So that's where the derivative liability, derivative claim analysis comes in. If in fact this court could recognize, which I understand is a concern because it hasn't been recognized, but if this court could recognize a negligent selection claim, it would have to look at what the elements are of that claim. And ultimately, those elements show that a negligent selection claim is a derivative claim because a derivative.
So you believe negligent hiring is also a derivative claim, I assume.
Yeah, any of those negligent hiring, negligent selection, negligent retention, all those fall in the same line, negligent supervision. Those are all claims that derive from an underlying act of negligence.
Well, it could be an underlying intentional tort in a given case, right?
Indeed, it could. And in fact, I think the John Doe case I cited out of Wisconsin was an underlying intentional retort, if I remember right, because there was a sexual misconduct claim that was barred. So it could be an underlying intentional tort, could be an underlying act of negligence. It has to
and
be.
And you think all of those are derivative claims, and even though they're not vicarious liability claims, they're derivative claims, and a parent are really, is there any case law that we can turn to that look at that distinguishes between those two and that decides that there could be no recovery for the direct claim of a negligent supervision, hiring, or selection?
So yes, not in Minnesota, outside of Minnesota. So a couple different things. The Doe case that I cited to gets directly into the issue of negligent supervision type claims and whether those claims exist if an underlying claim is barred. And usually the analysis is, it usually falls in the line of a statute of limitations barring an underlying claim. And then the upstream claim is barred because the downstream claim is barred. The release is no different. A release bars the downstream claim, just like a statute of limitations would bar the downstream claim. There is case law in Minnesota that I think the court can look to, though, for guidance. The Booth case talks about the effect of vicarious liability, so that principal and agent relationship, and what a Perringer release does to a claim against the principal. So when there's a principal...
But counsel, can I stop you there? Because the Booth case, when I looked at that, that did not involve a Perringer release, though.
I had thought that the Booth case did, and maybe I'm wrong about that, but regardless of whether it does, it's not disputed in this case. The appellant acknowledges that a Perringer release does not release a vicarious liability claim. That's not questioned and that's not disputed. The only dispute is whether the claim in this case, if it exists, is a derivative liability claim. And in fact, I'd actually point the court to page 11 of the appellant's brief. The appellant states, and I quote, Perringer releases release non-settling defendants from vicarious / derivative liability. Perringer releases release non-settling defendants from derivative liability. The distinction, I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and maybe you already answered this, but I just want to make sure the Minnesota law that you believe establishes that negligent hiring is a derivative claim. What is that?
That negligent hiring is a derivative claim. Yeah. I don't believe that. I don't believe negligent hiring being a derivative claim has any Minnesota law.
Right. Okay. That's what I thought, but I thought maybe I misheard you. So that also is an unsettled question of Minnesota law, is what you said.
That's an unsettled question of whether that specific type of claim is a derivative claim. There's Minnesota case law that suggests other types of claims. The most common is a loss of consortium claim. Is a derivative type of claim. Vicarious liability is another type of derivative claim. There's all types of derivative liability claims, and the court has repeatedly said in those claims, if there's a bar to recovery, then it bars recovery of the other claims. And it's no different with a negligent selection claim because the court, if the court, you know, looks at what the elements are that other courts have adopted, the nature of that claim is a derivative liability claim.
Assume for a moment, counsel, that we decide, and I mean, this may be a huge assumption, that negligent selection is a sufficiently established cause of action for the court to recognize in this case. And then we go into this issue of whether the Perringer release release claims against Knife River. Assume also, though, that we decide that negligent selection is an independent duty and creates independent direct liability on the part of Knife River, in theory. So how do you prevail on summary judgment?
So I think it depends on if the court just says it's direct liability and the underlying claim doesn't matter, then I don't prevail. But if the court looks to the Wisconsin case I cited, that was the exact issue that the court actually addressed, because the previous case law in Wisconsin had talked about negligent hiring claims being direct claims. And the court said, yeah, we did say that. That doesn't mean they aren't derivative claims, though. And so let me put it this way. No, go ahead, Your Honor. I can get back to what my thought was later.
I mean, this is maybe a prompt for you, but maybe I misunderstand the case. So your circuity argument, the question was, do you not prevail if with Judge Bradfold's hypothetical? But I thought that you still would assert a circuity argument based on the indemnity, the particular indemnity provisions of the contract.
Yeah, correct. I'm sorry. Thank you for that, Your Honor. Yeah, I didn't mean to say I don't prevail on the circuity issue still. I meant to say I don't prevail on the derivative liability analysis. So with that, let's just assume hypothetically that SP Trucking didn't settle for this derivative liability argument. If I went to trial and the jury would find SP Trucking has zero fault in this case, would the jury then get to the question of whether Knife River was negligent and negligently selecting SP Trucking? And the answer is no, of course not, because you first have to have that negligence from SP Trucking. And that's what the restatement says anyways. Or if you put it another way, let's say that Knife River has negligently selected 100% of its independent contractors. Does that mean that I would have a claim against Knife River just because Knife River has negligently selected all these contractors? The answer is no. There has to be that nexus in between, that accident that was actually caused by one of those independent contractors. Without that nexus, we don't have a claim. And that I'll submit to the court. That's why the appellant has focused extensively in his brief on the negligence of SP Trucking, because it's important to the plaintiff's claim. It's something that the plaintiff has to prove. Otherwise, we could simply go to trial and say, motion in limine, let's keep out any evidence of SP Trucking being negligent at all. You'd have the plaintiff being injured on the one hand, and Knife River allegedly not selecting someone by not performing background checks, and the jury would be left wondering, what's the connection here? What's that have to do with anything? My point is, it's a derivative claim because that underlying act of negligence is required. And
so, counsel, it's not an argument appellant made, but it just pops into my head. And so I just want to hear your response. It seems to me that you're also describing a case in which there is concurrent causation, independent causes of an accident. I mean, it's not uncommon for tortfeasors to have overlapping theories, for the plaintiff to have overlapping theories of causation as to separate tortfeasors. And it seems to me that's one way to look at this, and why the fault of both, all three tortfeasors would be submitted to the jury, perhaps.
Yeah. So I think the difference between what you're saying, Your Honor, the typical kind of multi-defendant case in this case, is that in the typical case, for example, Knife River would have been actually present at the accident. And so there'd be some fault on Knife River's part for being, you know, even if it was a minimal involvement, being at the accident, period. That's not where the fault in this case derives from, though, for Knife River, because Knife River undisputedly was not anywhere near the accident. Knife River's fault only comes from the fact that SP Trucking was at the accident and caused the accident. So
To play devil's advocate with you, I think that it's in some ways supports the argument that the appellant is making, that these are independent acts of negligence. They're claiming that the negligence, and I do believe that was briefed, that Knife River's negligence, according to the plaintiff, preceded the negligence that caused the accident. And that's, again, it's concurrent causation, different timelines, different facts. Yes, there is an overlap ultimately at the point of the accident, but I think that's their point. And again, although this particular case has a unique set of facts, this type of scenario has come in front of Minnesota courts many times, and usually the district court's judge's answer is simply to place all of the potential contributors, tortfeasors, on the verdict form and let the jury allocate the fault?
Yeah, so that is, and normally what would happen is the defense attorney, I'd say, I want that person that's been released on the verdict form so I can argue they're at fault. Well, Knife River can't do that because that just pins fault on Knife River because it's not completely separate. It's not completely separate fault. Knife River's fault is literally under the elements of a negligent selection claim. Knife River's fault is dependent on the fault of SP Trucking. And without that, the release of SP Trucking does release all claims after that. The other issue that I want to briefly touch on while I have a bit of time left is the circuity of obligation. And Minnesota has said that a circuity of obligation bars a plaintiff's claim. And it's circular indemnity. That's what that is, circular indemnity. So if there's if the plaintiff ends up having to pay back any money that it'll get from the non-settling defendant, there's circular indemnity. And it's a question of law. The court can look to the indemnity agreements at issue to decide that. And there's two of them. So the first is the ITO hauling agreement. There, SP Trucking agreed to indemnify Knife River for its performance of the agreement, whether that's from negligence, breach of contract, or otherwise. If something causes a death or injury out of the performance of the agreement, then SP Trucking has an indemnity obligation to Knife River. And the second, so that's the first layer of indemnity.
What about the limitation that's raised by appellant, the limitation in that? So there is no obligation on SP Trucking's part to indemnify Knife River for Knife River's own negligence. I think that's pretty explicit. And it's a very common provision in indemnity agreements.
Yeah, so a couple things. One, that was only raised in passing in one sentence at the lower court.
And but it's in the contract, counsel. So I mean,
Okay, so let me focus on that issue then, just assume that it was raised. So that still does not bar Knife River from seeking indemnity from SP Trucking, because it really gets back to the fact that Knife River's negligence, if it was negligent, only arises out of SP Trucking's negligence in this instance. It completely derives from that negligence. Your Honors, I see that I'm out of time. If there's no further questions.
Is there something you wanted to do to finish that answer? Because I would be happy to give you that.
No, I was just going to continue on with the indemnity analysis in the Perringer release. If you'd like me to do that, I can. It's in my brief, though, so I don't know that I need to get there.
Okay. And any other questions from the panel? Because certainly we did allow the appellant to go over. Okay. All right. And thank you, counsel. I appreciate all of your arguments. We all do. And in particular, noting that you have fully briefed these and the briefs are in front of the court and we carefully reviewed them. So thank you. So we have reset the clock. And counsel for appellant, you can begin your rebuttal when you're ready.
I do. And the focus of my rebuttal is going to be, again, revisiting this issue of derivatives / vicarious and whether that a negligent hiring / selection claim should be considered a derivative. And by derivative, you're saying vicarious liability claim. The answer to that question is a resounding no. And let me point out why. I have argued that the negligent hiring selection claim is independent of the negligence of the trucker. And that is quite true. Because here the question is, had the trucker been negligent in causing this accident, would that automatically result in liability on the part of Knife River? And the answer to that question under my theory, the negligent hiring and negligent selection theory, is a resounding no.
I think, no. Though, counsel, the argument, though, is not, I mean, is that there has to be negligence by the driver plus the parts about that you the claim that there was negligence in selecting. So, but that absent the driver's negligence, there can be no success on the negligent selection. If you selected negligently, but it was in a given case, it was the driver's fault. It was the plaintiff's fault, not the driver's fault, for example, that you there could be no recovery for negligent selection unless the truck driver actually was at fault.
But that's what I'm talking about here. If there was negligence on the part of the truck driver causing the accident, there would be that. There would be a direct connection between the truck driver and the cause of the accident itself. The theory against the hirer is that the hirer was present in the form of the truck driver itself, if you will. The accident was called the cause. The damage was happened, but we have a concurrence of causes here. You've got the negligence in time on the part of the contractor who decided to put the truck driver on the road to begin with. And then you have the negligence of the truck driver itself. But
isn't that sounds like a derivative claim, because it sounds like you're saying that the Knife River is stepping in the shoes of the driver. And there's plenty of case law, including on company derivative claims, of talking about when you step into the shoes of something. That sounds like a derivative claim, what you're describing.
Absolutely not. The only action that Knife River had in causing this accident was putting that truck driver on the road to begin with, just like in Ponticus, and putting the manager in the apartment building to begin with. That was the negligence. The manager then was able to assault the apartment holder. But it is not a derivative claim. It's wholly independent of the claim of whether we're talking apartment manager or here a truck driver. You have to establish different elements of negligence in order for the hirer to be held liable. So again, simply because the truck driver is liable for this accident that causes this damage doesn't mean that the hirer is automatically, that would be derivative, that would be vicarious, and that is not the negligent hiring count. It's indicated, it's been held in the cases here in Minnesota since Ponticus, that it is an independent, not derivative, not vicarious theory of liability itself. So that needs to be, I would ask the court disabuse itself of the notion or the language using a derivative / vicarious in any way as having any application to a negligent hiring / selection count, or a negligent supervision, or any of the other types of counts where we're talking about the responsibility of the hirer of the individual during the course of that relationship itself. Insofar as security of obligation is concerned, not only is there an absence of security in the ITO agreement, as Judge Bradfield pointed out, by the fact that the hirer is not indemnified for the hirer's own negligence. It's only indemnified for the negligence of the contractor. But also in the release itself, there's an argument that there is a security of obligation. But I would suggest, and as we have briefed, no, what we have is exactly identical to what the court was facing in the Graf case. And there is just a reference to the plaintiff indemnifying SP for medical liens or anything having to do with the medical care. Nothing having to do with indemnity claims by any non-settling tortfeasor. So there is no security of
counsel. Just to remind you, your time is up, and I know that you have fully briefed the Graf case. Otherwise, I wouldn't interrupt you. Is there one last thing that you'd like to say, a brief sentence or two?
Your Honor, no, just to point out again and to reiterate, as the court has noted, what we are talking about is a tort cause of action that for all intents and purposes has in fact been recognized and been applied in Minnesota since certainly 1990s, and Ponticus says it's been around since the 1980s. So I would just ask that the court undertake the review of the case law and recognize the public policy considerations favoring holding those who retain workers to do hazardous work, such as driving a truck on the roadways, to do a vetting. And when they do so, to do it in a reasonable fashion, because here we've got the evidence from the designee
himself.
With that, I would submit. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. Our thanks to the lawyers in this case. This matter is now submitted to the court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.